The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
GOP free-for-all. Who's in and who's out of the nomination race? Who's still waiting in the wings? And is their Medicare reform backfiring?
Iraq remembered. From Memorial Day weekend, a former Marine officer shares her unique view of the war there and other ongoing conflicts.
The tornado tracker, a top government meteorologist on the causes of wild weather like what crushed Joplin, plus progress in warnings and response.
Beyond the scoreboard, an accidental sports writer, as he calls himself, on some of our favorite games and players and what they say about us.
Social media overload. A tech expert proposes new rules and restraint for ever-expanding cyber life.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. A production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those with disabilities. For your ears only for the week of May 29th and Memorial Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm Tim Pawlenty, and I'm running for President of the United States.
If we believe in God, if we believe in ourselves, and we believe in the United States of America, then we can do great things.
Last night's results provide clear evidence that when voters learn about the Republican plan to end Medicare as we know it, they say no.
Minnesota's former Governor Tim Pawlenty formally entered the Republican presidential field last week, as did former Godfather's Pizza CEO and commentator Herman Cain, as we just heard. But current Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels took a cue from his family and stepped to the sidelines, joining former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, an early favorite, and media magnate Donald Trump. But the big news for Republicans was their loss of a traditional upstate New York congressional district in a race decided in large part by an increasingly controversial GOP House plan to replace Medicare with a voucher system. It was a turnaround with potentially national implications, as underscored next day by Washington State Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
For more on the emerging Republican field and those working in the wings, including Mitt Romney raising millions, Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann raising hopes, we have Ron Fauché, veteran political analyst and operative, now president of the Claris Research Group in Washington, for your ears only. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What does the latest polling of Republicans show about the relative strength of the candidacies, both announced and presumed?
Well, it basically shows that Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin, should she run, would be the two top candidates. And I think that's largely due to name recognition. Newt Gingrich has fallen. His negative ratings have gone way up. Tim Pawlenty really hasn't moved much in the last few months. The one interesting thing is that Herman Cain, who is normally considered a minor candidate by a lot of analysts, has shown some polling strength recently.
And what about the national favorable, unfavorable ratings of Palin and Bachmann?
Well, for Palin, her ratings have always been terrible. Her ratings among Republicans are not good. You know, when you consider that Palin rarely polls more than 14 or 15% of Republicans to be their presidential nominee, and she's known by virtually 100%, it's an indication that there's great resistance just among Republicans to her being president. So I think it would be highly unlikely that Palin ultimately would be nominated or could win a general election. Bachmann doesn't have the name recognition that Palin has, so she's not polling as well as Palin does. But of the people who do know Bachmann, you know, she is a polarizing, controversial figure.
What are the most important state polling results you've seen in terms of the national political balance?
Ohio's polling, Florida's polling is now showing that President Obama is clearly in the lead against any of the Republican rivals. We saw a poll today that had President Obama leading Paul Ryan, for example, in his home state in Wisconsin, should Ryan be a presidential candidate. So President Obama is at a high point relative to where he's been over the last year or so. The capture and killing of Osama bin Laden was a big part of that. I think the disruption in the Republican field, I think some of the problems Newt Gingrich has had and Mitt Romney has had, has also weakened Republicans recently. And, of course, the New York 26 race, even though that's not something that most voters are following the way political strategists would, I think it is an indication that the Republicans have now found themselves on the defensive on an issue like Medicare, which is a big issue across the country.
Well, Palin is moving to Arizona, plans a national bus tour with key primary state stops along the way. Michelle Bachmann is scheduling an announcement in Iowa, the key early bellwether state. But Mitt Romney must take the prize for pre-campaign campaigning and fundraising, $10.25 million in a day. What is he waiting for?
Well, I think he was waiting for the other candidates to get themselves shot at by getting out there first, by taking the hits, and then he would quietly sit back as the default candidate and emerge when nobody else could get anywhere. And that ultimately may be a good strategy for him, because Mitt Romney in this field has always been in the position not so much as the front runner, but as the default option. You know, if Gingrich can't cut it, and if Palin doesn't run or can't cut it, or Pawlenty doesn't get anywhere, or Huntsman doesn't get anywhere, then Romney would be the fallback candidate, and that may not be a bad strategy for him.
We've talked about how Obama is doing following the bin Laden takedown, up and down economic news, controversy over his Libyan military initiative, and peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians. How enduring do you see those issues as we move into the 2012 vote?
Well, those are all very important issues, because at any point, any of those things can flare up. The situation in the Middle East, the situation, the war on terror, any of those things can become hot at any given moment. So they always have importance. I do think that even though President Obama's so-called bounce in the polls after the capture of Osama wasn't as big as a lot of people thought it would be, it has held up for a while, and it's put him strategically in a much better position, because there's a big difference between when you're president, when you're polling, say, at about 45-46%, which is where he was, and when you're polling at between, say, 50-51, 52-53, which is where he is now, and the difference is between winning and losing re-election, and he's now on the upside of that. So, but, you know, we can't forget about the economy. The economy is still the number one issue. Voters are not happy with it. They don't think it's necessarily getting any better. And ultimately, the president has to face that.
The Tea Party forced Gingrich to back off from distancing himself from that Republican Medicare plan that sunk their candidate in New York. How do you judge the Tea Party phenomenon generally at this point? A vital new direction for dissatisfied voters of both parties, or an ideological weight around the Republicans' neck?
Well, I think it began as a place for people who were not happy with politics as usual to go. And about two-thirds of the Tea Party voters started off as being Republicans, and about one-third were unhappy independents who were unhappy with everything, and they saw that as a protest vehicle. I think the Tea Party is now operating almost exclusively within the Republican coalition, even though that may be somewhat different than the actual Republican Party, because there may be some people in the Tea Party who are not Republicans. But I think the bottom line is that, yes, the Tea Party is a force within Republican primary politics, certainly would be a force within Republican caucus politics in a presidential campaign. But our polling shows that the Tea Party movement has higher negatives right now than it does positives. So in terms of general election politics, it has its limitations.
Ron Fauché is a veteran political analyst and operative, now president of the Claris Research Group in Washington.
Quote from the news, in order to move forward, Serbia had to swallow this bitter pill. That was Kurt Bassanier, a Sarajevo-based policy analyst, on the government's long-sought arrest of Europe's most wanted man, former Bosnian Serb general Ratko Mladic, after 15 years on the run from war crimes charges, including the massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys. President Boris Tadic said the arrest wiped the stain of bloody ethnic conflict and paved the way for entering the European Union.
Next, for Memorial Day, a female Marine officer looks back at Iraq. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelrath.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I've come home to find the apostrophe we lost somewhere along the way. That was President Obama visiting Ireland, home of his great-great-grandfather, at the start of a European trip that included a historic address to Britain's Parliament in Westminster Hall. But British Prime Minister David Cameron did not back Obama's opposition to a vote for Palestinian status at the United Nations, and Obama sidestepped a call by Cameron and French President Nicolas Sarkozy to escalate military actions against Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Back on Capitol Hill, a bipartisan coterie of critics complained that Obama's continued support of NATO's air war on Gaddafi's forces passed the 60-day limit set out in the War Powers Resolution.
The Southern Movement is ready to take any necessary action. In the event that the troops refuse to leave, be it positive or negative, such as mass strikes, demonstrations, and military action.
Sounds of the shock and awe attack that preceded the U.S. ground war in Iraq in March of 2003 and threats this month by opposition leader Muqtada al-Sadr of new violence if any U.S. forces remain at the request of the Baghdad government after their promised withdrawal. Indeed, two American soldiers were among 20 people killed in recent rocket attacks in the capital, part of a resurgent tide of ethnic violence. And last week, the official in charge of purging Iraqi institutions of those linked to the regime of Saddam Hussein was shot dead driving home in Baghdad.
On this Memorial Day weekend, we look back at the Iraq War and ahead to continuing conflict in the area from the special viewpoint of Marine Reserve Major Jane Blair, who fought there. Her new memoir of it is Hesitation Kills, a female Marine officer's experience in Iraq, from Rauman and Littlefield Publishers. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Melissa and David. I appreciate it.
You weren't an officer to begin with. Tell us what led you to join the Marines and how you rose to the rank of lieutenant by the time of the Iraq War.
Well, you know, I started off from a very different background. I didn't have any family members in the military. I grew up in Miami Beach in New York. And so when I looked into going into the military, I started asking a bunch of Marines, you know, what was the best avenue to join. And everyone I talked to said, if you want to be a real Marine, you should go enlisted first, because then you're going to know exactly what it's like. And so that's what I did. I started off, and, you know, it was a very humbling experience for me, actually, because I thought I would be doing cool things like, you know, storming beachfronts, and instead I was learning to swab the deck and scrub the toilets. But, you know, all in all, frankly, it really made me into a better officer when I finally became an officer, because I really learned what it was like to treat Marines the right way.
What was your assignment in Iraq, and how dangerous was it?
I was the collections officer at an unmanned aerial vehicle unit, and we basically went ahead of frontline troops because we were an aerial reconnaissance unit. And, you know, frankly, it was extremely dangerous. I mean, there were constant threats. You never knew what was going to go ahead of you. Especially during the initial ground assault, we had no idea what to expect, whether gas attacks or whether, you know, Scud attacks. We were pretty much left to any kind of threat ahead of us.
You also faced special challenges from male officers, doubts about your ability, and bullying because of your gender, though bullying seems fairly common in the Corps.
Reflecting back on it now, I think as a second lieutenant, there's a certain amount of rites of passage that you go through as a junior officer. Similar to maybe the police force or other professions like that. And so as a young officer, I think, you know, it's kind of natural to go through that. And until you find your place and learn how to be a leader. And as a female, you know, I learned I really had to become a Marine first, a Marine leader first, and not make any excuses. And once I started falling into sort of the behavior of what was expected for me as a leader, I think it became much easier, and the female issue no longer seemed to be relevant.
What differences did you observe about the way male and female Marines dealt with fear, death, and the challenges of leadership, and how did you deal with them?
Seeing both the men and women in a combat situation, I really didn't see a lot of difference. You know, people bottle up, I think, that fear a lot is what I saw on the battlefield, is really people internalizing the fears that they felt. And for the most part, the Marines were really courageous. It was amazing to see such young people out there and, you know, sacrificing and not making excuses and just willing to fight even, you know, at their death. So very courageous. For me, you know, internally it was very hard to come to terms with the fact that you could die at any moment. And I had to really grapple with that at the beginning mentally. But I think once you get enough adrenaline in you, you kind of just have to charge on with the mission. And it doesn't, you lose that fear a little bit because the adrenaline's so high and you're just going off and you kind of forget. You lose your perspective of where you are.
Where do you stand on an amendment to the 2012 Defense Authorization Bill that would lift all remaining limits to women serving in combat, in part to equalize chances for promotion?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting issue that has surfaced as of late. I'm not a policymaker, and I think it's really a question for Congress to answer and to decide whether they are ready or if they want to make this change at all. We are a civilian-led military force for a reason. And, you know, as a member of military, I defer to when Congress, if they ever think it's right for females to enter that role. But certainly, I think if people want to get insight into what combat is like and from a woman's perspective, they should read my book, Hesitation Kills, and really draw their own conclusions.
Like many U.S. service personnel, you missed your spouse, but you also had special opportunities to see him from time to time, thanks to the Corps.
That's correct, yes. I was very lucky. I remember during a two-week period when all of the units were retrograding and they all combined into one central area, I had an opportunity to see my husband by chance.
He is also a Marine and now a Marine Reserve officer.
That's correct.
Since your service in Iraq, you've become a student of Arabic and won a master's degree in strategic studies. From that perspective, what changes would you have made to the U.S. strategy and tactics in Iraq?
You know, that's a great question because I think it's so important, having seen the difference from understanding a culture's language to not, and how my view of the culture has changed. I think it's so necessary for our troops, the military, to study the culture before they go there and to come up with specialized training throughout the world of different cultures. You know, we live in a globalized society now. It's impossible for us not to have relations really with all countries throughout the world. I think that it would have impacted the way that we fought in Iraq had we engaged it from a more educated perspective, understanding the Arab culture more, the tribal systems, and the language for sure.
Well, given the resurgence of ethnic violence, do you think that anything short of another brutal strongman like Saddam Hussein can keep all of those rivalries in check?
I think that we are experiencing a great change now in the Middle East, where many different Arab nations are seeing that a strongman in place is really not the answer anywhere, and people are kind of taking social responsibility for their own countries, even in Iraq. I think it's phenomenal that that people throughout the Middle East are realizing that there's a role for them in politics and in society beyond the usual. It's not just up to one leader to decide people's fate.
Marine Reserve Major Jane Blair is the author of Hesitation Kills, A Female Marine Officer's Experience in Iraq, from Rauman and Littlefield Publishers.
Quote from the news, complete knowledge of every bullet fired and the number of those killed or wounded. That was former Egyptian spy chief Omar Suleiman on the complicity of ousted President Hosni Mubarak with the killing of at least 846 people during the protests that led to Mubarak's ouster and for which he now faces charges of murder as well as prior corruption.
Next, the tornado tracker, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. There will be no makeovers, no surprises. You will not be getting a car or a tree. That was Oprah Winfrey ending her daytime television show after 25 years as an icon of self-empowerment, confessional entertainment, cultural awareness, and influence. She hoped her loyal audience would, quote, connect, embrace, liberate, and love somebody, unquote, and follow her new Oprah Winfrey network on cable. Now this.
Take cover right now. We do have a tornado on the ground.
This is a tornado. Yeah, this is a very dangerous situation. We cannot stress this enough. If you are in Joplin, please take cover right now.
The news team at KSNF-TV in Joplin, Missouri, abandoned journalistic objectivity as last Sunday's record tornado hit the ground and spread a wide swath of devastation that killed at least 132 people and left 1,500 initially unaccounted for. By week's end, the number of missing had been reduced to about 150, but officials were slow in disclosing how many had been found alive or dead.
Recovery from a tornado is complicated by disruption of transportation and communication, even the destruction of familiar landmarks. But technology has made for earlier tracking and warnings and better understanding of the factors that spawn a killer twister. For an update on that progress, we have one of the federal government's top tornado trackers for your ears only. He's Gregory Corbin, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
First, tell us about the Storm Prediction Center. How many folks with what expertise and what kind of equipment?
Well, we are to tornadoes as the National Hurricane Center is to hurricanes. And so we've gathered up dedicated meteorologists here that have worked throughout the National Weather Service and put them to task on the experience that they have and put that to task in trying to predict severe weather, both in the form of tornadoes, but also large hail, damaging winds, and even wildfire conditions across the continental United States.
Are you using radar? Are you using observation posts? What feeds your center?
Well, really, it starts with the people. We're using experience. We're using the ability to detect patterns and familiarity with forecasting extreme events. And then, of course, you bring in the technology such as computer models and then also radar and other observational data such as satellite information and surface observations.
How much earlier can you spot the factors that can produce tornadoes and their actual formation than 5 or, say, 10 years ago?
Well, what's fascinating of what's really happened in the last few years is for the very first time, meteorologists have had the ability to begin to convey their certainty or uncertainty with certain weather patterns and weather conditions. Not every weather pattern is as predictable as another, and this predictability changes from day to day and from season to season. Some patterns are relatively easy to predict, and others are not so easy. The predictability is usually done with a series of computer models, what we call ensemble forecast models, a lot of different models providing the same output, but on different scales and different times.
Some people complain that their localities are a little too quick with the sirens when inclement weather rolls in, and they end up being ignored in the most serious cases, case of Cry Wolf. Is that a concern?
I think that is a concern, and I think we need to know more about some of this. I think perhaps we've been maybe a little bit too aggressive in terms of being too good at getting the warning out, and we need to take a look at some of the situations that have occurred this spring and wonder whether people have become somewhat complacent because they're overwarned or over-alerted in certain situations. It's very difficult with tornado forecasting to be able to actually forecast tornado intensity. That's something we've really never done before. We've kind of treated all tornadoes the same.
Talking about strong tornadoes, I gather we're experiencing extraordinary levels of tornado fatalities, about 500 this year versus a normal 60 or 70, and yet the number and violence of the tornadoes is about average. Why the disparity?
Well, I don't know whether we can say we're talking an average year here. I mean, I think we're going to experience a record number of tornadoes in April. May is a little bit strange in that it started very slow, but it certainly has picked up. There are a lot of factors that are all different with respect to why we're seeing some of the trends or disastrous events we've seen this year. Some of the impacts or some of the conditions we're more confident about, perhaps, would be population changes and population density changes that have occurred over the years. We also know that as we go into April and especially May, those are the active times of year for severe weather, especially in the Midwest and the southern United States. And the rarity of violent tornadoes is such that these are going to be scattered about throughout decades of time. And so it may seem like this year is very unusual, but the nature of violent and extreme weather is such that it's interspersed with long periods of relative calm and quiet. And so it seems like all of a sudden we see more storms around. But in fact, it's quite possible that this is a cycle that is followed over a long period of time. But we've added these other things like increased population and perhaps increased vulnerability. And maybe it's not so outrageous to think we will have relatively large fatality totals from time to time, unfortunately, because we haven't really perfected any method to reduce the intensity of the tornadoes. They're going to be as strong as they've ever been, but once in a while, they're going to move into densely populated areas, and we're going to see these unfortunate results.
The big question on many minds is the connection between extreme weather and global warming. You've said some changes may increase the danger, while others decrease it. Give us an example.
Okay, mostly tornadoes are driven by wind shear in the atmosphere. Not so much the instability that fuels thunderstorms, but actually shear drives tornadoes more so than instability. You need a change in wind speed and direction with height in the atmosphere. And one thing we think we may be seeing with global climate change, and especially a warmer world, is an eventual decrease or a shift in where these stronger zones of wind shear will set up in the atmosphere. We know in the springtime months that wind shear is quite prevalent across the central United States when you have strong weather systems moving through, and that contributes to the violent weather we see. In a warmer world, it's quite possible that zone of wind shear would lift or migrate northward toward the Canadian border, or maybe be non-existent at all across the continental United States. In those regimes, we may actually see more thunderstorms because you've got warm air and moisture laying around, which can provide fuel for thunderstorms, but the wind shear that's required for tornadoes will be almost non-existent. So these connections that feed into severe weather are going to be modified based on global climate change, but it's not quite clear whether that will favor additional severe weather or less.
Gregory Carbon is warning coordination meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma.
Next, sports are us for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. With this quote from the news, we've engineered physical activity out of our lives, so we've got to find ways to put it back. That was Washington University epidemiologist Ross Brownson on a new study showing a previously ignored factor in rising obesity rates, the decrease of workplace physical activity. Now this.
Whitey Karowski, Max Lanier, Eddie Waitkus, and Johnny Vandermeer. Bob Estalella, Van Lingle Mungo.
Back in the 1940s, young Robert Lipsight, a self-proclaimed non-sports fan, had no business knowing all those names of Major League ballplayers later made famous in a song by Dave Frischberg. But chance led the would-be novelist from Columbia College to decades as one of the most distinctive sports reporters on the New York Times, or anywhere in the nation for that matter. He went on to write sharp-eyed social commentary, author books, and host TV shows, later developing a fondness for sports when he didn't have to cover them.
Now Lipsight has a memoir that explores what the games we play and the heroes we worship are like close up and what they say about us and our society. It's an accidental sports writer from Echo Publishers this month. And for your ears only, we have Bob Lipsight on the line now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So why weren't you a born fan in a sports town like New York, and what was your thing?
Well, my dad and I went every week to the library instead of to the ballpark. We never talked sports in my house. I lived in Queens, which meant we really weren't caught up in the three teams in New York. It's kind of a dead zone. So I was spared that. And, you know, in some ways it became my strength and weakness as a sports writer. I mean, I really don't have the wonderful background that kids who were sports fans had growing up, like knowing the names of that song.
You recall loving the old Western movies and came to see sports taking their place in the creation of national role models and life rules, for better and worse. In what ways better and what ways worse?
I think of center field as the Plains, and instead of, Lash LaRue, are galloping across. It's Mickey Mantle. I think we really did lose something, because there was something about the fantasy Western, and it was a fantasy, about right and wrong, white hats and black hats, about some sort of code of honor. And I don't think that when that was replaced by sports, and now we're talking, you know, celebrity big-time sports, we kind of carried on, you know, that cachet of character building. By the way, I have to tell you that I think of sports as the most fun you can have with your body in public legally. But I don't think that, and we conflate that dream that we had of childhood sports, you know, with what these thugs are doing in, you know, football, baseball, and basketball.
And it isn't any longer, you know, not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. It's winning is everything. It's the only thing.
Right, and I think that so many of those kind of values of jock culture, it's not only winning is everything, but, you know, if you can win ugly, if you can dominate, if you can cheat. I mean, there's a certain cachet in cheating as well, which has kind of leaked into the fabric of everyday life in this country.
It was because the bosses at the Times didn't think a poetic pugilist then named Cassius Clay was very important that they sent rookie Bob Libsight to cover him, your first big story. I only got to cover Clay when he refused the draft. Talk about the relationship that you developed with him, what you saw his Muhammad Ali persona coming to symbolize about sports and about America.
Well, I mean, the Times feeling, the instructions I got when I went down to cover that, was drive back and forth quickly between the arena where the fight was being held and the nearest hospital so that I would waste no deadline time following Cassius Clay into intensive care. And I think that that sense of he was an underdog, you know, I was certainly an underdog. I was a kid off Night Rewrite being sent because this was not an important enough event for a real reporter. And we were kind of the same age. And older reporters, whose beau ideal of the athlete was Joe Louis, you know, I do my talking in the ring. Here was Cassius Clay, who was bombastic and funny and somewhat dismissive of them. He didn't really see them as being so important. And so, you know, we bonded over that. And then when he won, my goodness, I became the boxing reporter. And he was kind of a window on the rest of the world. He's very soon announced that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. White America was terrified. This was Malcolm X's organization then, and didn't realize it was just, you know, kind of a voodoo splinter group. And so following Ali for, you know, for the next 45 years or something, really was a way, in a sense, to look at America and other countries as well sometimes. But the idea of racism, classism, sexism, the outsider, and the way we create and destroy our heroes.
Towards the end of your memoir, you learn a lesson from a famous fan of yours, the sportscaster Bob Costas. Talk about that and what you made of his criticism of your approach to sports.
Well, Bob Costas and I are still trying to work out our relationship. You know, he's 14 years younger than I am and very rich and famous. So I was at first flattered that he, you know, this is like 20 years ago, takes me out to dinner to tell me that he liked my work, but if I had a little more celebration and a little more joy, I'd be bigger. And I think in response I said something, well, Bob, you know, if you didn't shill for Major League Baseball so much, you'd have more integrity. And it kind of spun a little out of control after that. In the book, I call him, you know, a great broadcaster. I think he's the best I've ever seen, and also something of a shill. And he walks that line gracefully. And so Bob and I, over drinks and text messages, since the book has come out, have been trying to figure out maybe we can change. Maybe we can find a way to kind of look at sports, on the one hand, as more of a joyful celebration, because that's what it is. It's not news. It's an aspect of the entertainment industry. But on the other hand, also look at it more searchingly, because it does have impact, particularly on young people, whether we like it or not.
Bob Libsight is a veteran reporter, author, TV writer, and personality. His new book is An Accidental Sports Writer from Echo Publishers.
Eddie Basinski. Ernie Lombardi, Huey Mulcahy, Van Lingle, Van Lingle, Mungo.
Next, managing social media madness for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Thanks for the freak show. That's what some in the courtroom audience heard Jarrett Lovner say as a judge ruled he was mentally unfit to stand trial in the killing of six and wounding of Representative Gabrielle Giffords. Now this.
Megabyte and gigabyte are the bytes to beat spam and cookies. Not the kind you eat. Geek is fear and piracy. There's no privacy. Hackers find out all about you, don't they? Never had so much information, but what about the art of conversation? I wish we could know where this will go, where to.
When she wrote the lyric to that Brazilian tune, the late Susanna McCorkle could hardly have imagined how far it would go. Privacy is practically an analog age antique. Social media like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and so many others are hailed for connecting us to, well, everything and everyone. But are they really helping or hurting? A new study by Harmony finds these and other internet functions are wasting up to an hour of work time every day. For businesses with 1,000 employees, those interruptions cost more than $10 million annually.
And on a personal level, the benefits of social media are clear. Finding jobs, keeping tabs on family, friends, and of course their photos, getting recommendations on everything from restaurants to tennis rackets. But so is the chaotic competition they constitute for our concentration. With us to talk about social media overload is Tom Dunlap, who wrote about the problem for PC World. He also writes for Everyday Connected and is the author of How to Do Everything with Your Sony Vaio. Welcome to the show, Tom. About social media overload is Tom Dunlap, who wrote the problem for PC World. He also writes for Everyday Connected and is the author of How to Do Everything with Your Sony Vaio. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, guys.
How big a deal is social media these days for individuals and businesses?
Well, you know, social media is pretty huge for both. For businesses, it's very important for most companies that they have a vigorous social media strategy. I don't see 20-somethings reading newspapers anymore at all. And then high-tech companies use Twitter like crazy. I mean, they do so much of their marketing now on Twitter. And, of course, for individuals, you know, there's all kinds of information about how big Facebook is. You know, they've passed the 500 million user mark. Something like 75% of teens are on Facebook, according to one study. It's huge.
You say you used to delight in valuable information on Facebook and Twitter, but you can barely find it now. What was useful then? What's overwhelming it now?
Yeah, here's a good example. So I'm a huge fan of the San Francisco Giants. And they have this great beat writer, Henry Shulman. And he puts updates on Facebook just occasionally. And I look forward to those, you know, and they're great. And I also like when my friends put up interesting stories or comments. But I'm having a harder and harder time finding those because so many other people are posting 10 comments a day, or they're liking sites, or they're posting on other people's photos. And it's just, you know, when I call up my Facebook page now, I mean, I literally cringe because I just have to dig through so many messages, or I have to hide so many to get to the ones that I'm looking for. And for me, and then that's Facebook. For Twitter, for me, it's like I used to use it a lot, but, I mean, I find that it's kind of just gets the information overload.
You propose some new rules of the road for social media to minimize overload for all concerned. Let's start with use and abuse of Facebook. What do you recommend?
So my new rules are you may post only one update per day. You may like or comment only one item per day. You may not add more than one video or photo per week.
Ouch.
And this is particularly true of baby or cat photos. And then don't constantly change your status. And then finally, never poke anyone outside your immediate family. Although the truth is, I don't exactly know what a Facebook poke is. So I don't know if I'm supposed to poke back or what it means.
Yeah.
You also propose new restraint on Twitter.
So, I mean, I think you should limit yourself to 2 tweets per day. I mean, I know that's hard for the Kardashians and that kind of stuff. But the normal people out there, limit yourself to 2 tweets per day. Don't auto-follow everyone. And don't create endless hashtags for organizing your tweets. I don't know if you guys know about hashtags.
Well, if you can quickly say what it is.
Well, it's you put the crosshatch mark next to a word, and then you send a tweet out about that, and then everyone can comment on that same subject. It's a way of kind of, you know, streamlining or organizing your tweets.
You also have some new rules for stumble upon and dig, but first tell us more old-fashioned types, just what each of those is and does.
Those are called news aggregators, and the way it works is if you find an interesting online article, you go to dig and you post a link, a headline and a link to that article on dig, and then other dig users vote on it, and, you know, and there's thousands of them, and then at the end of the day, the most popular stories out there are on the Dig homepage. And StumbleUpon is the same. The thing is, there are now tons of these news aggregator sites. There's too many. And they've also kind of, over time, they took, which was a good, something that was a good idea, and they've added so many things to their sites and tried to network so much that the sites are kind of a pain to use now.
So bottom line, when I send you a Facebook invite later today, will you friend me, connect with me on LinkedIn, and follow me on Twitter?
Okay, I'm going to friend you, Melissa, but if you send me or if you post a cat picture, I'm going to unfriend you.
I like my cat pictures.
Tom Dunlop writes for PC World and Everyday Connected and is the author of How to Do Everything with Your Sony Vaio. Now a final word on the problem from McCorkle.
I'm old-fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how I want to be, as long to stay old-fashioned with me.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Perhaps the most radical injunction issued by a court in our nation's history. That was Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia dissenting from a 5-4 order that California reduce its overcrowded prison population by 30,000 to end, quote, needless suffering and death.
For Your Ears Only is online anytime at iTunes News and Politics or podcastbunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donations. Please email david.ears.only@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Noriko Okabe at Argo Studios with intern Kate McGee. I'm Melissa Exelbert.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of Gatewave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on this show a year ago.
This week last year marked the end of this show as Newsweek on Air, so we replayed some of our best segments from nearly 30 years under that name, including this one, so well suited for Memorial Day weekend, from our March 25th, 2007 Newsweek on Air program, replayed on our May 30th, 2010 Best of Newsweek on Air finale, hosted by Melissa and me. The shock and awe bombing of Baghdad 4 years ago, followed quickly by the battle outside a building where Saddam Hussein and top aides were mistakenly believed to be hiding. Since then, the war, as we know it, has come through mostly in the reports and images filed by journalists, the official statements of military spokespersons, and the spin applied by political leaders for and against the initial invasion and the way the war has been carried on since. This week, Newsweek tells the history of the war through some of the words of 3,200 who fell fighting it, an extraordinary collection of letters and emails from U.S. military personnel killed in action, shared by their next of kin.
There is patriotism, endless concern for comrades, early optimism. Later, exhaustion, doubts, and fears. And always there's a bond of love with those back home, especially in the so-called last letters most soldiers write in advance, to be sent only in case of their deaths. Like this from a Marine Lance Corporal killed in Anbar Province.
Hi, Mom, Dad, Brittany, Jeremy, and Bailey. If you're getting this letter, then I'm sure you've already heard. I'm so sorry. But know that I'm safe now. I'm with God watching over you. You all mean the world to me. I hope I've made you all proud, and please don't be sad. I made it to heaven before you, and we'll see you all again. Your loving son and brother, Anthony Edward Butterfield.
For more on our Voices of the Fallen special issue, we have Newsweek Deputy Washington Bureau Chief Dan Efron and Karen Meredith, mother of Lieutenant Ken Ballard, an armored platoon commander who died in Najaf in May 2004. First to Dan, how many letters or emails did you collect?
Well, we reached out to about 1,000 families. We had a team of about 10 reporters working on this. So of the 3,000 or so families who lost loved ones in Iraq, we spoke to about a third of them. We received the letters of about 200 service members who were killed in Iraq. And then we're running the letters of about 40 service members in the magazine.
And how did you find these soldiers' letters and persuade their families to cooperate?
Well, we found these letters and these service members by simply combing through the lists of people who were killed over there and reaching out to the families. And I think that what was common when we spoke to them initially was a concern on their part that we wouldn't use these letters to make some political statement for or against the war. But I think once the families were reassured, there was almost without exception a real outpouring towards our reporters, sending in emails, faxing in handwritten letters, even sending us by mail, the voices of their loved ones that were recorded in Iraq.
We hear the Pentagon has a report holding four generals and five other officers responsible for misinformation about the friendly fire death of pro football star Pat Tillman in Afghanistan. Any cases like that turn up in reporting this project?
There were other cases, and I think there have been at least six or seven glaring cases like that where the families were misinformed. But I think you should ask Karen Meredith about that, your next guest. She is one of those cases.
Newsweek's Dan Efron. Next to Karen Meredith, whose son Ken was still able to note the beauty around him in Baghdad in August of 2003.
We were crossing the Tigris River at night under a full moon. The light was dancing on the water. A light breeze floated through the trees. You think to yourself how nice this would be with someone special. Then flares light up the sky, and you see tracer fire off in the distance, and the cold slap of reality sets in.
Within weeks, Ballard was embroiled in widening discontent and had a new perspective.
The locals are different in every sector. In our old sectors, we were able to build good relationships. In our new area, it is a very different place. Openly hostile is closer to the mark. Our CO wants us to embrace them with open arms and love our fellow man. Too many of us have a bad taste in our mouths about it all. They have no respect for weapons, each other, and life. And if that is the case, then how are we supposed to look at them differently?
Now to Karen Meredith, Ken's mother. He joined the Army back in 1995, well before the war on terror began. Did he have any second thoughts about a military career after 9/11 and the risk of combat?
Ken was actually in a college. He was a senior in college and on September 12th, and he wrote in his journal the next day that the nation wants blood because of their anger of the attacks, but do they understand that in spilling their blood, ours will flow too? When this war does start, I should be back on the front lines. I really hope that I will make the right choices and keep those people under me alive.
And how
he did that.
And how did he feel when his unit's tour was extended in April of 2004, and how did you react?
They had been in Iraq for 12 or 11 months at that time, and Ken's response as a young lieutenant was, "We still have a mission to complete." And the families, of course, were devastated.
We mentioned before misinformation in the case of Pat Tillman, and Tan Efron suggests that was a problem in your case, too.
Yes. When the Army told me that Ken was killed in May of 2004, they told me he was killed by small arms fire, by enemy fire. And 15 months later, they came to my house and told me that Ken had been killed by the accidental discharge of the machine gun on his tank.
You've set up a website in Ken's memory. What lesson do you want people to take away from it?
I want people to know that Ken is more than a number, as are all the other 3,200. And I want people to see that who he was and that he was more than a soldier, but he loved being a soldier. And I want people to know that he brought this world laughter and love in a million different ways, as do all of the soldiers to their families.
Ken got a college degree in the service. What were his plans for after the war?
He still would have had a few more years left on his obligation to serve, but he had planned on speaking to some people in the State Department. His major in college was international relations, and so I think he would have brought something good to this world.
We know Dan Efron talked about families not wanting these letters to be used for political purposes, but do you find yourself over the course of time since his death, since the war began, taking a position or being asked to take a position on the war?
My position against the war has always been the same before, during, and now. But your product or your project, people will find war to be political regardless of their feelings. But the way I understand that you're telling the stories, people will reach their own conclusion, and that you didn't use our children's names to make any political statement.
And what about your own activities in protest of the war or against the war?
I am very active in that. Travel to Washington, D.C. several times a year. That also gives me the opportunity to visit Ken at Arlington. But I'm very outspoken against this war.
Karen Meredith is the mother of Lieutenant Ken Ballard, killed in Najaf in May 2004. We also spoke with Newsweek Deputy Washington Bureau Chief Dan Efron.
Voices of the Fallen, from our May 30th, 2010 Newsweek On Air broadcast, originally aired March 25th, 2007. As we heard earlier, the possibility that Washington would be asked to keep some troops in Iraq to help control revived ethnic violence has prompted new threats from anti-American extremists, even as the Taliban escalate their attacks in Afghanistan. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week.